Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, April 3rd, 2025, we're delighted to host a discussion on two cases relating to the control of schools over student and staff speech. Henderson versus Springfield R12 School District, and Parents Defending Education versus Olentangy Local School District Board of Education. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Brett Nolan, who's a senior attorney at the Institute for Free Speech, a public interest law firm that works to defend the First Amendment rights of those engaged in political speech and advocacy around the country. Before joining the Institute, Mr. Nolan served as the Principal Deputy Solicitor General of Kentucky, where he represented the Commonwealth in a wide variety of high-stakes litigation at every level of state and federal court. Prior to that, Mr. Nolan served as the Deputy General Counsel to the former Governor of Kentucky, where he advised the governor and other executive branch officials on legal and policy issues and represented them in litigation. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Edward Grime, who's a partner at Graves, Garrett & Grime, LLC. His practice focuses on complex commercial litigation, free speech and election law, as well as internal investigations and whistleblower claims. His free speech and election law practice has included numerous constitutional challenges to election and campaign finance laws, representation of clients in state and federal ethics and campaign finance enforcement actions and investigations, representation of not-for-profit clients before state regulators, advice on campaign and election law compliance, and litigation of state and federal redistricting issues. He's argued before the Missouri and Kansas Supreme Courts multiple times and other state and appellate courts across the country, as well as before the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 10th U.S. Courts of Appeals, and recently for the Supreme Court in a case being heard this term. And I will leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that questions there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Grime, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Welcome today, Brett. And just as a note, because of how we're doing this as a litigation update, Mr. Nolan is going to first walk through the Henderson case and kind of give us a background there, and then he'll go through the second PDE versus Olentangy case, and then we'll have some questions afterwards. So I'll make no other introductory remarks, and I'll turn it over to Brett Nolan.
Thanks, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this litigation update, because I think that these are two cases that are set to, you know, be really important in the coming years on some legal issues that are generating, maybe to put it lightly, some increasing friction these days. And so I'll start with Henderson, and Henderson is a case in the Eighth Circuit that centers on a public school's mandatory equity training for staff. The plaintiffs in this case worked for the school district, and they were required to attend an equity training which focused on concepts like anti-racism and white supremacy. But this was not a training in which the individual staff members showed up and simply listened to the speaker. The school district required the plaintiffs to participate in a training by discussing their own views about these topics and divisive sort of current political events, such as the Rittenhouse shootings and the George Floyd protests. And when the plaintiffs in this case expressed views that the instructors did not agree with, they told the plaintiffs they were wrong. They told the plaintiffs they were born into white privilege, and they allowed members of the training who were there, other participants in the training, to berate them without stopping them. So the plaintiffs eventually stopped speaking during the training out of fear that they would continue to be chastised by the instructors, characterized pejoratively as being white supremacists. There were also two other parts of this training that kind of gave rise to this case. One is that the plaintiffs were required to complete training modules where they gave answers to things like whether they agree with the statement, if I am a white person working with a person of color, I will likely be perceived as a person with power and racial privilege. One of the plaintiffs ends up answering that question with answers that are contrary to her real beliefs because she thought that the district would require or expect her to do so, and she needed to give the correct answer to get credit for completing this mandatory training. The other aspect of this training that the plaintiffs have focused on particularly troubling is it sort of goes to some of the tenets of this anti-racism, you know, ideology or instruction that the district was promoting, which seemed to the plaintiffs to compel district staff not just to adopt or listen to the viewpoints that were expressed during the equity training, but to commit to becoming anti-racist educators, which meant advocating for changes in political, economic, and social life. And so the plaintiffs, you know, filed suit over this, bringing claims that this is, you know, this mandatory training discriminates based on their viewpoint and compels them to speak in ways that are against what they believe. And so there's a lot going on with their claims here, but I think, you know, maybe the way and you hear the plaintiffs sort of characterize it, especially in the most recent argument, is that the bottom line is that these trainings, these equity trainings, were really infused with a pretty divisive political ideology about race and identity. And the district and the instructors working for the district clearly took sides in terms of where they aligned with that ideology and left the plaintiffs with the impression that there would be professional consequences if they didn't affirm the district court's, the school district's ideological views, both during the training and beyond the training when they're in the classroom and in other circumstances. The plaintiffs, they lose this case at summary judgment. The district court grants summary judgment to the district, and they appeal to the Eighth Circuit. And the Eighth Circuit the district court's grant of summary judgment. And the panel holds that the plaintiffs, you know, just lack standing because their claims of chilled speech or the compelled speech turn on a speculative fear. And so what the panel focused on was that no one was punished in the sense that they lost their job or received a reprimand from the school district. And so the plaintiffs fear that they would face professional consequences if they didn't affirm the school district's viewpoint or if they remained silent was speculative. The court said, something like, so long as these employees were not punished or threatened with punishment for remaining silent or expressing disagreement with the district's program, they could not establish an injury from the required attendance. In rejecting the plaintiff's sort of theories of their injury, they also reject the plaintiff's theory, a slightly different theory than just the chilled expression. It's a theory that the plaintiffs are injured by being shamed by the trainers with this pejorative language, such as being called a white supremacist, and that sort of shaming and that pejorative label being affixed to the plaintiffs if they don't speak and if they don't speak in a way that the district wanted them to, that is enough for their injury as well in this compelled speech case. The panel rejects that argument. Part of that seems to rest on a factual dispute about whether the trainers did enough to call them white supremacists. The panel seemed to hold that this, you know, theory of an injury would only apply if the district had clearly labeled the plaintiffs in this way, referencing something like wearing a name tag or an armband that would classify them as a white supremacist if they hadn't affirmed the district's viewpoint. The plaintiffs, you know, pushback on part of that is that at least there's an inference here that that's what was going on and this is summary judgment. But the panel rejected that without sort of a much clearer use of the pejorative label to describe the plaintiffs. Now, this case, both of the cases that we're talking about today are interesting because the panels lost at both stages, and then both circuits granted rehearing en banc. And so this case was argued in front of the en banc court a couple months ago on January 15th. And the argument went about how I think you might, you know, sort of expect it. It wasn't a quiet, you know, court, but it also wasn't a really, really hot court. There were lots of questions for the plaintiffs about how they could be injured without any actual repercussions. They, you know, didn't lose their job. They weren't punished in any way for not speaking once they decided to stop speaking. And so isn't this injury really speculative? And there was also a good amount of questioning about how you would draw the line for the plaintiff's theory that being labeled something pejorative like a white supremacist can give rise to a First Amendment injury. What exactly is pejorative enough? Is merely disagreeing with someone? Surely that's not enough. The plaintiffs agreed at the argument that if the instructors had just expressed disagreement, that wouldn't be enough. But where do you draw that line that something is so pejorative that it creates a First Amendment injury for the plaintiffs, for the individuals who choose not to speak or to say something that they don't believe in to avoid that from happening. On the other side, though, there was a good amount of support from the court, I think, if you're trying to read tea leaves on questions, for the idea that this kind of mandatory training session that requires participation and it includes this kind of, you know, feedback interaction with the instructors where they're, you know, critical of your views and it leads to sort of this audience part, you know, berating you and the district is really emphasizing, you know, its viewpoint and pushing you to adopt it, that this would obviously chill the speech of an ordinary employee who knows that this training is mandatory and maybe doesn't know what the consequence is or would be, but believes that, you know, at some level, their job performance, the review of their job performance is going to depend on completing this training in a satisfactory way. So I think one of the big picture of things to think about with this case and as it comes down, and I think it goes to the issues in a different case that we're going to talk about in the Sixth Circuit, is there is a growing sort of issue where, you know, there's a divide but between what we might have seen in the past as what people would generally think of as fairly neutral human resources kind of principles and rules that you can give employees without crossing a viewpoint line or a compelled speech line. And we've had those for a long time. They've been litigated some, but a lot of people sort of accept these as kind of neutral things that even the government as an employer can do. And that the school district in, you know, some of its argument sort of says that it has implemented this training in response to those kinds of things, harassment, bullying, instances like that. And so it implements this equity training, but this equity training is maybe of a totally different kind of character than what we've seen before. It's sort of presented as maybe a more neutral kind of view of anti-harassment principles. But these ideas behind anti-racism and gender ideology, and what constitutes harassment under those sort of ideologies is expanding. And so what a school might have previously thought as a run-of-the-mill anti-harassment kind of training session is now something that is instructing employees on issues that, you know, are the same issues that are driving elections and are very divisive. And so once you start requiring individuals to affirm those or adopt those beliefs and implement them, it's a very sort of different kind of thing than what we've seen in the past. And of course, that becomes an even greater problem when, you have the government that is requiring its employees to do this kind of thing, which is essentially taking sides in a really important ideological and political sort of social disagreement that our country is in the middle of. That's Henderson. Like I said, it was argued a couple months ago. So hopefully we'll see an opinion come out maybe this year.
Okay. Thank you. With those notes, I've made some notes. I think some of our audience members have as well. There's some questions bubbling up, but let's move on now to the next case, Mr. Nolan, and then we'll go back and start knocking out some of those questions.
Sounds great. So our next case is Parents Defending Education v. Olentangy School District. And this, like I said before, is in the Sixth Circuit, and it comes after the denial of a preliminary injunction. And like Henderson, this is a case where the plaintiffs lost at the panel stage. The Sixth Circuit granted en banc, and that it was argued in front of the en banc court just a couple weeks ago on March 19th. So this case also involves a school, but instead of regulating the speech of its staff, this is about regulating student speech. And so we're sort of firmly in the tinker world with this case. The particular speech codes at issue here, there's, I think, four of them, and they're all a little bit different, but they could be, I think, fairly summarized in this way, which is that the school district has adopted several anti-harassment and anti-bullying policies that prohibit students from intentionally misgendering other students, which means referring to someone with a pronoun that does not align with that person's preferred pronoun based on his or her view of what they call their gender identity. The plaintiffs are people who do not believe that gender identity exists. They reject sort of the gender identity ideology. And so the idea of calling someone by their preferred pronoun rather than a biologically sort of tied or biologically accurate pronoun would require them to speak something that they believe is untrue by affirming not just the person's preferred gender identity, but the idea of gender identity at all. And so under these policies that the schools adopted, a student would violate them when they, anytime they would use a biologically accurate pronoun to refer to another student who prefers a different pronoun because they identify with a different gender. The policies also, I think, capture some other forms of similar speech, such as disagreeing with a particular student about what his or her gender is. But the court and the parties have mostly, focused on this pronoun issue as being, I think, the best encapsulation of what this policy does and how it works. So I think it's helpful to just think about it as sort of this, misgendering issue. So the plaintiffs challenge these policies. They bring a lot of, several claims that saying they unconstitutionally compel speech because they require them to, affirm the idea of gender ideology, that it discriminates based on viewpoint because whether one agrees with the, gender ideology sort of viewpoint or is a viewpoint. And so by using preferred pronouns rather than biological pronouns is an expression of that viewpoint. And then they bring a tinker claim where they argue that the school sort of implemented the speech code without any of the evidence that would be necessary to prove that they're reasonably forecasting a substantial disruption in the education environment. The school district in this case really didn't produce any evidence on that front. It adopted the policies or it didn't produce any evidence that it adopted these policies in response to an actual disruption. And there wasn't really any evidence at the PI stage, at least, that they had a concrete belief that, disruption at the schools in its district was likely to occur. Rather, the school district's evidence, or if there, I'm not sure, there's a dispute about sort of what evidence was in the record or not. But the district court sort of holding focused on some studies related to how misgendering and using pronouns when someone has a different gender identity, how that affects them, emotionally and causes psychological harm in general, rather than anything specific to this district. So the Sixth Circuit, the panel that heard the case, denied all the plaintiffs' claims across the board. It held that this wasn't viewpoint discrimination because the plaintiffs can still express their viewpoint about gender ideology in other ways, and that banning hostile speech like this is not necessarily a viewpoint ban. The court also held that it wasn't compelled speech either because no one has to use pronouns. Students could simply avoid the rule by referring to other students by name. And on the Tinker issue, the Sixth Circuit, held that there was sufficient evidence that using non-preferred pronouns is humiliating or dehumanizing, which would allow the school to preemptively impose a rule like this. And in doing so, the court relied on common sense conclusions that the district is allowed to draw to forecast disruption, which meets the Tinker standard. So the Sixth Circuit, though, vacated that decision. Like I said, they heard argument on March 19th. And there's just a couple things that I'll highlight maybe from that argument to think about maybe where this case is headed. The first question in that argument, which I think came from Judge Murphy, asked the plaintiff's attorney whether a school can discriminate based on viewpoint when regulating student speech under Tinker. The Sixth Circuit has precedent that says no, that a school has to comply with both Tinker's substantial disruption test and the Supreme Court's other precedent about how viewpoint discrimination is prohibited for speech on government property. But Judge Murphy asked the plaintiff's attorney whether that was consistent with Morris v. Frederick, which is probably better known as the Bonk Hits for Jesus case, in which the Supreme Court upheld a rule that prohibited students from promoting illegal drug use. And the gist of Judge Murphy's question was that how is that consistent with the idea that schools can't discriminate based off of viewpoint under Tinker? And I'm not sure. I don't think that the parties have asked the court to overrule the Sixth Circuit to overrule its precedent, but it has at least been teed up. And I don't think that the Supreme Court has ever directly addressed this issue. And so it would be interesting to see what the Sixth Circuit does with that. The second thing, to look at is how the Sixth Circuit deals with this compelled speech issue. So, by way of short background, there was another case in the Sixth Circuit from a few years ago called Merriweather that involved a professor who didn't want to use preferred pronouns, wanted to use biological pronouns. This was not a student speech case. And in that case, the professor made a compromise that he could use the last name of the students rather than any pronouns at all. And the school in that case rejected that, which then cut against the school, and the professor ends up winning his appeal. The plaintiffs, though, argue here that regulating the student speech in this case is a lot different than that, because unlike a professor who is a trained speaker and has a kind of a limited window of time in which they're interacting with students and instructing students, these speech codes affect students all the time in the classroom, in the hallways. I think some of them even reach maybe beyond the classroom. And so the argument is that the idea that a student could just stop using pronouns and only use someone's first name or last name is just not realistic. And so they compare it to the Supreme Court's decision in Woolley v. Maynard, where the court said it was no defense to New Hampshire's compelled speech on a license plate to say, well, you don't have to have a license plate. You don't have to have a car. There's just some things that you have to do. And if you, and in order to do them, then there's a compelled speech issue, then you can't sort of, as the government, throw your hands up and say, well, just don't drive. And that's the plaintiff's argument here, is that students really can't stop using pronouns. That's, no one's going to be able to do that. It's not how people speak. And even one slip up would violate this policy. And then the last thing I'll just say about the Tinker issue, because I think it's a really big one, which is, it's this issue of what does a school have to show when it wants to ban student speech preemptively before the school has experienced any kind of disruption. So one of the problems with the district court's decision and the panel's decision that there's a lot of focus in the en banc argument is that the decision has the effect of putting certain kinds of disfavored speech and completely off limits for students because the viewpoint itself is deemed harmful to those who might hear it. And the panel's decision leans on some evidence that may or may not be in the record, that students who believe in gender identity, who believe that they have a gender identity that's different from their biological gender, are emotionally harmed in a pretty serious way whenever someone uses a non-preferred pronoun. And that this is a similar reasoning that was adopted by the First Circuit in a case where the court upheld a school's ban on a student wearing a T-shirt that read, "There are only two genders." But it's sort of easy to see where this kind of reasoning might take you. This is, you know, some of the plaintiff's argument is that if a court decides that some individuals are particularly, you know, fragile to hearing some viewpoints, then that viewpoint becomes completely unprotected under the First Amendment. But there are a lot of decisions from the Supreme Court that said you can't ban speech simply because it's offensive. And so how does a court decide that speech is so offensive that it can be banned? Not because it's necessarily disruptive in the traditional way we might think of disruption, but it's disruptive because it's offensive. And how do you stop that from empowering groups from banning one side of the debate, you know, by claiming or arguing that hearing the speech is too harmful to their side of the debate? So this is, I think, a real problem that courts are going to continue to deal with, and why I think that this case is so important, because we're in a world where you're having, you know, increasing arguments about words being violence and harmful. And the thrust behind that is to just remove disfavored viewpoints from public discourse. And so, you know, when this is in the context of schools like it is here, and I think this is, you know, one of the animating concerns of Tinker, is that if you're teaching students that some viewpoints can be removed from public discourse, then those students will one day graduate and go out into the real world. And that's the way that they're going to think about free speech. And so we have to be really careful in figuring out what exactly that line is. And this is pretty new territory for the courts, I think, in trying to draw that line on these kinds of very sort of emotionally charged topics. So I will turn it back to you and see what kind of questions we have.
All right. Well, thank you, Brett, very much. We do have a couple of questions. I'm going to knock out one question myself.
thank you.
From one of our commenters about some of the facts of Henderson, and a little bird might have given me the answer to this, but the question is, did the school, did Springfield, Missouri, use the Corwin curriculum? And the little bird suggests that no, Springfield had their own full-time equity staffer who pulled the information together off the internet, and that's what the students were taught. So I'll do that myself. There's another question though regarding Henderson. I'll just read you the question. For Henderson, you mentioned how the courts questioned the injury to the plaintiffs. Did 303 Creative come up at all when prepping or an argument? I think let's put aside the prepping, but maybe the question is, did it come up during argument? There were some questions about standing or speculative injury in 303 Creative, and this questioner was wondering whether there was any nexus with the case. Brett, do you know the answer to that question?
You know, I don't recall it coming up in any of the argument. It's certainly, you know, 303 Creative doesn't, you know, there was a lot of discussion about standing and the speculative sort of fear of injury, I think, outside of the court. But the decision itself, if I recall, the court was pretty, everyone was in agreement that there was an injury in that case. And so that is, there's definitely a nexus, I think, to some of the discussion around 303 Creative and some of the discussion that maybe came from that in some other cases, but not in court or the specific details from that case here.
Right. And that's my recollection of 303 Creative too. The question in Henderson really does seem to be, you know, putting aside the different categories of injury and how you want to class that under the different lines of precedent, you know, arguably it's how objectively reasonable is it for the teachers to believe that there will be some punishment? I think everybody agrees they don't actually have to be punished. I think everyone agrees that there doesn't have to be probably a written policy that says first offense X, second offense Y. But you know, how reasonable does it have to be? And that that may be the common question to all the different theories. Do you think that's right, Brett?
Yeah. And, you know, this case presents, I think, kind of an interesting maybe spin or take on that problem. Because the school district argues that one or both of the plaintiffs, well, I mean, they argue that these plaintiffs did speak. They weren't totally children speaking. The plaintiffs concede that, and they say they stopped speaking at some point once they sort of received that pushback. And there's some maybe an argument from the school that one of the plaintiffs spoke at another public meeting about this training, which showed that she really wasn't that worried. That's their argument. She wasn't that worried about repercussions because she went and spoke about this in another context. And at the argument, the counsel for the plaintiff made the point that this is an objective standard. Now, usually what that means is you see that brought up when a plaintiff is sort of too chilled. They're too worried about consequences. But it was made in this context that if these plaintiffs sort of have a stronger backbone than some, that doesn't actually affect the analysis because it's what a reasonable person and how they would sort of perceive this. And I think a lot of that argument is that a typical staff member at a school who's told they have to attend a mandatory training and sort of receives all this information and the totality of the information is going to respond in a way that they're not going to feel comfortable saying what they really think because they're going to be worried about what that might happen with their job.
Right. It's sort of like the eggshell school rule from torts.
Right.
Extra timid people don't get the benefit of enhanced standing. But, you know, especially robust and brave people don't get dinged on their First Amendment claims.
You know, and I'll add, there's a lot in, I guess it happens in the school context, I guess. There's also a link, I think, to this and some other cases that have been circulating in the courts of appeals that have drawn, I think, now two dissents from a cert denial. In some cases brought by the organization called Speech First, which deal with, on college campuses, some of these rules about reporting bias and things like that. And all of those cases have dealt with this idea that if someone may or may not be able to punish you in some unknown way, how much does that really reasonably chill your speech? And I think a couple circuits have said not enough. A couple circuits have said, yeah, that's definitely Article III standing. That's enough to get you there. And the Supreme Court has denied at least two cases that have kind of raised that same issue over some dissents.
That's interesting. By the way, a little note here. Apparently in the 303, I'm sorry, in the Henderson case, 303 Creative, this case goes back a ways. 303 Creative came out in between the district court decision or between the trial court and the appellate court. And apparently the school district argued that they could compel speech in order to combat discrimination. And then they withdrew that argument. It was not heard from again. After 303.
Interesting. That's interesting.
So, okay, let's go back to the Q&A. And, there are no open questions, but I thought I saw another one. I've got a couple of questions for you. Just to step back from both of these cases, you know, if you're reading the news recently, it seems to be that a lot of colleges and a lot of corporations are pulling back from some of their DEI initiatives, which is not the same as this, as these cases, but there's sort of a perceptible swing in the pendulum back the other way. And so do you think that these cases are really just, kind of already becoming historical remnants of an interesting period of peak wokeism, or are they really going to have continuing significance in the future?
That's a good question. This, you know, it obviously wasn't like directly addressed in the argument, but this theme definitely appeared in the Henderson argument. At one point, the district's attorney was talking about how these trainings have been discontinued, and there was at least some suggestion via questions from the court and back and forth that the intervening elections maybe had something to do with that. I think the plaintiffs dispute that factually, that they've been totally discontinued. But there certainly at least was like a little bit of a discussion in the en banc argument about how the political winds, you know, may have shifted away from this kind of equity training. And then I think you see the same kind of thing, you know, happening, you know, with the way school districts are responding to the change in Title IX and, you know, the issue of allowing, you know, biologically male athletes to play in women's sports, and how school districts have changed their positions based off of the election and how that kind of thing, how that has swung. I think it's still important, though, you know, for a lot of reasons, that these issues are, one, they're broader than necessarily the particular kind of training that's at issue, or the particular speech code that's at issue. I think that when you look at, you know, these disputes over pronouns, the disputes over anti-racism and gender ID, all of these kinds of things, you see similar themes where, like I said sort of earlier, where, you know, schools are adopting or agencies are adopting what, you know, they might view as sort of these neutral principles because in a way that is a lot broader than, you know, maybe the one particular policy that once these things become embedded, as part of the ideological background for a lot of people, and they stop viewing these as viewpoints, then I don't think that it necessarily stops when you have a change in an election. And I think also the other reality is that we're a really diverse country, which is great. And it means that some places where maybe the political winds are more 50-50 will swing, but other places are not going to change. And it doesn't matter that, you know, the current White House is on a crusade against DEI and initiatives like that. They're going to continue, you know, doing what they believe in. And these local districts, these local governments, it really matters, you know, what your speech rights are when you're in school, and all of that's controlled locally. And so I don't see these issues going away, even if they get better.
I want to ask you a question about Olentangy. I think maybe I said it wrong. I'm about to say another name wrong, I think, too. It's part of my question to you. It's the Mahanoy case. It's the cheerleader case. Yes. The cheerleader didn't make varsity, and she complained. Then she even got thrown off JV from a few years ago. So do you think, and you mentioned the off-campus applications of these speech codes in Olentangy, is it possible, can that case be decided as overbroad based solely on the off-campus portion of it without having to reach the really tricky viewpoint discrimination and Tinker interplay that you raised?
I certainly think it's overbroad, but what I don't really have a good sense of is whether that could be severed off. And I think that it probably could be, especially with a court, you know, the Sixth Circuit has probably, you know, a majority of a more conservative leaning court. But it's a court that is more likely to issue narrow rulings than broad rulings, I think, even if it's going to be a more conservative decision. And so I think that even that if parts of the policy were problematic, I think that you could probably see that severed off. I think another way, though, you could see a narrower ruling in this case that's still like maybe a complete win for the plaintiffs, but in a sort of a narrower way, is, you know, there was a discussion at the argument about the difference between banning someone from using the pronoun, the wrong pronoun once, and what might be pervasive bullying or harassment. And everybody wants to have a rule that allows for anti-bullying and anti-harassment and that sort of that standard of what makes it pervasive. But at one point in the argument, I believe it was Chief Judge Sutton said that he thought that it was astonishing that the school district took the position that using a biological pronoun rather than a preferred pronoun is per se harassment. And so I do think it's possible you could see a narrow ruling that focuses on that as being the real, you know, the real problem here is that per se sort of element that leaves open, you know, the possibility that some sort of ban or on using biological pronouns versus preferred pronouns is okay in the right circumstances, but this idea that doing it, you know, is always per se harassment is not okay.
Okay, you mentioned Judge Sutton. Now I'm going to put you on the spot. Triggered a question. Some of us followed Judge Kethledge pretty closely. Can you recall, did he ask any questions in the en banc argument? And can you tell what direction he was headed? Oh, you're on the spot. I'm going to test your memory.
I recall hearing Judge Kethledge's voice at the argument, but I don't recall what the questions were. I want to say he might have asked a question about the cheerleader case. I might be confusing someone, but I want to say because there was actually a discussion similar to yours of nobody knowing how to pronounce that case, and I feel like I remember Judge Kethledge talking about it, but I'm not sure. And he's, I think, you know, a judge who, you know, will often you see joining and writing opinions that are a lot narrower than some of the other conservative judges. So it will be, I think, interesting to see where he would come out on something like this.
So one more question came in, and I think we'll do this question and then make one final call and then maybe just ask for any remarks you have summing it up here. The question is, does this provide any clarity where prohibition of, quote, fighting words on one side squares with prohibition of the, quote, heckler's veto on the other? Now, that's the exact question.
Sure.
I'm not sure.
I don't know how strong the tension is, but you know, the Supreme Court doesn't allow you to regulate speech on the idea of a heckler's veto, which is what I was talking about earlier, that just because speech is offensive to someone, that you can't stop it. And then you see that sort of manifest itself in some ways, that if your reason for stopping speech is because someone is going to get so mad that they're going to be disruptive, you can't stop the speech for that reason. You have to take care of the disruption. But on the other hand, you know, there sometimes speech, I wouldn't call this necessarily offensive, you know, fighting words. If you have speech that is, off the top of my head, I couldn't say what the exact standard is, but the speech has to be so sort of immediately likely to cause like violence or something like
that. Constitutionally unprotected.
That falls outside of the First Amendment. I don't think that there's a lot in sort of at least at this time that these cases, especially I think this is more about the Sixth Circuit case, would get into that. There is, I think, maybe a lesser version of that where you're not talking about fighting words, but you're talking about words like vulgarity. And the Supreme Court has allowed schools to sort of restrict vulgarity, even when it's less than, obscene speech in some circumstances, when it's student speech in the classroom or part of the school events. I think there was one question about that from, I think it was Judge Nalbandian, who was comparing this speech to other similar cases where you've had bans on like Confederate flags, and asking whether, you know, misgendering someone or using the wrong pronouns, is it like a Confederate flag? And is that something that's different than vulgarity? And there's a lot of, this is a really unclear area for the Sixth Circuit and for, I think, a lot of the courts in terms of like what falls in that vulgarity box. And are there other things like racially hostile speech that the schools can regulate in a way that's different than other kinds of speech? And so I do think that there's a chance that whatever the Sixth Circuit does here cleans up, at least for it, that the circuit, what those categories are and how this kind of falls into them.
Well, okay. I'm going to ask a follow-up question on that. I mean, it just occurred as you're answering that question, thinking about some of the cases you're mentioning, that do you think that there are maybe some deeper problems with the doctrine in this area with Tinker and other cases because so much of the content of the test turns on the existence of something like a cultural consensus about what's permissible and what's not. You know, unlike maybe other areas of First Amendment law where it doesn't hinge so much on that. Is that maybe an Achilles heel in this area of the law?
I think that for a lot of cases, I don't think it's a big problem, because most of the courts have taken pretty seriously the evidence of disruption issue. Mm-hmm. I do think that it is where you see a lot of the lines getting blurred and it being a problem is racist speech. There are a lot of cases, especially in the 2000s, about Confederate flags in schools from across the country. A lot of those cases involved, you know, what I think what the courts at least described as like things that we would all think would be disruptive. A lot of, you know, violence amongst students and disruptive events. And the courts there are a lot of good decisions that have sort of said, well, listen, if you ban the Confederate flag, you have to ban, you know, no matter who is showing it, whether they're for the Confederacy or against the Confederacy, because the problem is the disruption that the flag is causing. It's not necessarily the viewpoint. But, you know, in particular, the Sixth Circuit's cases have been, I think there was a lot at the en banc argument, all of the judges and the lawyers were sort of all in agreement that the cases are kind of a mess. And I think that part of that mess is because of what you're referring to is everybody agrees that like certain, you know, racially problematic racist language surely can be banned in schools. I think that there is probably like a consensus amongst a lot of people, and you try to write a rule or a decision that allows you to ban that without opening the door to other things. And, you know, you see that in, you know, other contexts as well. Like you hear about race being treated differently under strict scrutiny and, you know, in other contexts. And I think that there's a lot of historical good reasons why that's the case. But I think that that question sort of highlights what we're seeing here in these cases, a big problem where there is maybe a cultural consensus among a lot of the decision makers, people who work for the schools, people who are in the higher up, the administrative, that is not, you know, the same as what the cultural consensus of the people, the population might be. And there's a real disconnect between someone who, you know, gives an anti-racism lecture believing that everybody agrees with, nobody disagrees with this, and the reality on the ground that these are incredibly divisive. And I think that that disconnect is very real. And that's I think what I was trying to highlight a little bit earlier, which is that we are seeing, I think, increased fights over these things because of exactly what you're saying, where you're seeing a consensus among some people who are maybe making the decisions that doesn't match the rest. And some of the time the courts have sort of gone in that direction as well. I think that the First Circuit's decision that I mentioned about the t-shirt, that I think that's another example where there is at least some sort of maybe cultural consensus that kind of speech can be banned. And it's just different than other kinds of viewpoints that maybe we wouldn't want to ban.
Yeah, interesting. You brought us back to Henderson. Poetically there. Okay, well, I was going to let us go, but we have one last question, and it's I don't think it'll take us all the way to the end of the hour. So the question is there any sort of qualifier on the tinker disruption standard? In other words, what if the disruption is itself irrational? You know, it's almost like the heckler's veto. You know, the heckler causes a disruption, like going after Tesla or whatever, that itself is wrongful conduct. I mean, are there any cases that distinguish that and say those kind of disruptions don't trigger tinker?
So off the top of my head, I'm not sure. I can't think of any that would sort of say it in that way. But I do think that there is What you will see from the courts, and someone might know some cases that I'm not aware of, but I think what you can see is that is the ban on whatever is disruptive, is it really a viewpoint ban? And so I think that in that way, I think there's a way to go about, you know, filtering that out by dealing with the disruption, by maybe punishing the students who are causing the disruption, without having, on the theory that, you know, if you were to just ban it entirely, really, this is just viewpoint discrimination because one side is intentionally causing this disruption in order to shut it down. I'm not sure of a case that has said that. It might be out there, but I'm not aware of it.
Well, a lot of interesting stuff here. Brett, are the arguments, are the en banc arguments online for Henderson?
Yes.
And for the, they're both on there.
Okay. Yes, they're both on the court's websites. You can search them by the party, case number, all that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for a fascinating discussion. These cases, who knows, may even be headed up, but first we have to get the decisions and we'll be all be watching very closely. So thank you very much. Kayla?
I'll echo those thanks. Thank you both so much for carving out the section of your afternoons and sharing your expertise and insight on these two really interesting cases. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, we can wrap a couple of minutes early and give everybody back a section of their afternoons and we can be adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.